for an entire generation, people have experienced Star Wars the only way it's been possible, on the TV screen. But if you've only seen it this way, you haven't seen it at all.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
We've been waiting for you.
Welcome to Coffee with Kenobi. Here are your hosts, Dan Z and Corey Club.
Hello, and welcome to Coffee with Kenobi Special Edition Star Trek Into Darkness, J.J. Abrams, and Episode 7. This is Dan Z, and today we are going to go into detail on the latest Star Trek film, J.J. Abrams as a filmmaker, what we can expect from Episode 7 with J.J. Abrams at the helm. With me is my good friend and co-host, Corey Club. Corey and I thought it would be a lot of fun to do a special episode on this topic while making sure people know we are not turning into a Star Trek podcast, so no worries, people.
Yeah, isn't Coffee with Khan or anything like that, so...
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
Thank you.
You are the master of the names and the puns. I think what we're going to do here is, first we're going to talk about what we liked. Why don't you go ahead and go first, Corey? What did you like about the show?
I thought it was a great sci-fi film. I mean, again, you know, we're not huge Star Trek fans. We do have a, you know, respect for it. And I think it was a lot of fun to see those characters again in the sequel. The way they just, you know, got along with each other, the more the characters came out of their shells a little bit more, the way they interacted, this, you know, the pitfalls of really the Federation, everything that was going, they were going through at the time, I think was really cool to see that. As far as that, I mean, special effects were awesome. And other than that, I mean, I think it was a lot of fun film. I enjoyed it. I really did.
Excellent. Well, for me, and we're going to talk about this a lot more when we talk about Abrams as a filmmaker, but the cast is fantastic. Mm-hmm. It's suspenseful. It's well paced. There's not a dull moment to it. And I think we can both agree with the name Benedict Cumberbatch. What do you think of him?
Oh, man, he was great. He got my attention when I watched him on the BBC series Sherlock. It was an excellent rendition of the character, and his acting is wonderful. He puts everything into it. He enjoys, I think, getting into each character, you know, good or bad.
And this is probably a good time for us to mention there are going to be spoilers on this podcast. So if you have not seen the film and you don't want it spoiled for you, then I would suggest pausing it and coming back to the show after you've seen the film. And then you will appreciate it more because we can't talk about this without talking about spoilers.
Agreed. Yes. If you're looking, you haven't seen the film yet, I suggest go out and see it, check it out, and then come back and listen to the podcast. So, yeah.
And I want to point out, I did love the film. In fact, I think I may have enjoyed it more than Iron Man 3, which is saying something for me because I'm a big Marvel guy too. The only thing is I wasn't crazy about some of the things that happened at the end. We'll kind of get into that in a little bit more. Do you want to go into more detail about what you like, per se?
Sure. I think as far as the storyline itself, it was paced pretty good, like you said. It was well done. I enjoyed the characters.
J.J. Abrams, the way he crafts a story, the way he gets his characters to connect. And I really liked, and I liked this in the first one too, I liked the interplay between Spock and Kirk. And there's tension. And it's not the Nimoy and William Shatner thing. I mean, it's there. They mime it. They obviously take that as a rich tapestry of characters, if you will, and characterization. But they don't try to mimic it. They make it their own. And just, you never know how they're going to interact with each other, the way they're going to, they mess with each other. There's obviously affection there, but there's still dramatic tension and just the way that you know they're friends, but it just seems more believable as character.
Yeah, I agree. And like I said before, it just heightens this in the sequel. I remember watching the first sequences of those two characters in the same scene, and I remember thinking, oh man, what are they going to get into next? And I think they seem like they're just even better friends. You can just tell from their, just the way they act and their expressions and everything. And it's a great way to be able to, you know, return to these characters and see what happened.
And why don't we just talk about the actors now in this? I mean, everybody in this does a tremendous job, and we were going to say this for later, but we might as well just talk about it now. J.J. Abrams knows how to cast a film. I mean, this is a volatile situation. Star Trek fans, as we know, are very passionate, as are Star Wars fans. They have very, very specific ways of how they want to do things. I'm not well-versed in Star Trek universe, as are you. So I would assume, I'm pretty sure that people like Chris Pine as Kirk. They love Zachary Quinto as Spock. In fact, on a more recent episode of The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon talks about the fact that that's one of the things he actually liked that changed, which is a big deal for him. Great show, of course, by the way. John Chu is Sulu. Simon Pegg, of course, our famous and favorite prequel hater. Zoe Saldana is Uhura. Carl Urban is Bones. They're tremendous. Their chemistry, the way they interact with each other, it's awesome.
I agree. And also, I think he knows how to cast new characters. Alice Eve came in and played a role as the daughter, and I think she did a great job of intermixing with those characters who are already set in their ways. And I think she did a great job of kind of a love interest slash, you know, protagonist of the series. And I think it was good.
What did you think about that controversy when they featured her in her bikini, so to speak? Did you see all that?
I saw all that. I did. But I think in that scene, it was more like, I don't know, it was those two characters were kind of almost coming to grips with each other as far as what had been going on in the storyline thus far. And she was kind of trying to get a little bit of power over Kirk in that scene. They're trying to obviously go do some different things. And so I think she needed to play that role and be able to, actually, she had to do that in a sense to, you know, kind of get her way in a sense.
Interesting. So you're saying that she had to strip down to her skivvies to get her way with Kirk?
I think so. I mean, obviously we have another scene too with Kirk where he wakes up in the bed and his alarm's going off and there's two other, you know, females wake up as well. So he's obviously a ladies' man. I mean,
and that's something. So. Yeah, they I don't know if they overplay that. I mean, it's a different format than the 60s. So they're a little more explicit in what they view and what they show.
Sure. Yep.
They definitely are specific in that. And then, of course, in that scene, Alice Eve's character, I can't even think of her name right now, but she's the daughter of Peter Weller of RoboCop.
Oh, I saw that in the credits. I was like, I knew who that guy is. I couldn't place him. And I said Peter Weller. I was like, oh, man, it's RoboCop.
You know who
that
else?
Awesome.
He's also, yeah, it was. He was excellent. He's also the voice of Batman in the Dark Knight directed DC movies, too. Did you know that?
Oh, nice. No, I didn't know that. That was nice. That's
yeah, good. So they already set up the fact that he dated one of her friends and he can't remember her name and he's a ladies' man and he doesn't respect women. He's a misogynist. We get
sure.
that.
Sure.
A lot of people were really up in arms about that. And apparently, there was a scene where Benedict Cumberbatch, there was some sort of a scene with him, too, with his shirt off, and they cut that out. So the producers are really under a lot of fire for putting that in there. I mean, I can understand what they're talking about. I don't think that's a huge point of contention for me. I mean, that's what they do in movies. They try to put random things in there. I mean, Deanna and I joke all the time. Whenever you see an action trailer, there are explosions. There's some scantily clad woman. It's how they try to get butts in the seats.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know.
Well, anyway, too, it's like obviously Star Trek is obviously a fan-driven series. And, you know the fans are going to be there. They're going to check out even if they love it or if they hate it. And, you know, any general populace that are looking to go see a film would want to see it. And obviously from the previews, they want to see action, adventure, explosions, something epic happening, and some skin. So that's just the way America is, sadly.
Right. And it is sad. And I really hope that's not going to be a present in Episode 7. I do not think that is going to be the case. But we wanted to address that controversy. And, you know, feel free to send us your thoughts on that.
Well, you think about it, Dan. I'm sorry to interrupt, but think about it. You know, Princess Leia was obviously scantily clad in Episode 7, Episode 6.
Yeah, she is going to have a trainer for Episode 7, but, you know, I don't know.
I don't think we'll see her, but you never know. You never know. But let's move on to that. Let's move on to the next topic, and it's about what we don't like about Star Trek Into the Darkness. Go ahead, Dan.
Okay, I want to, before we get into that, we need to talk about the elephant in the room. You know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't.
Who's our main villain?
Oh, well, I'll say it. It's Khan.
It's Khan. Okay.
It's Khan.
I can tell you right now, before it came out, and this is a big thing with J.J. Abrams too, he's huge into secrecy, which I personally love. I detest spoilers.
I agree.
I loathe them. Before Episode 6 came out, I read a third of the novel, and spoiler alert, Yoda dies. Okay, I don't know if you knew that. but I knew that he died, and I read it out loud, and I said it to my brother. And I think to this year, it was, you know, 30 years ago, I don't think he's ever forgiven me. I hate spoilers. So they kept hinting around, who is the identity of the mystery villain? Basically, they were telling us who the villain was without telling us. And then one of my students a few months ago came into my classroom, and he said, I know who it is. I think it's Khan. And he knew the name of the who Khan supposedly plays at first. And I can't even think of the name of the guy off the top of my head. John something?
John Harrison.
John Harrison.
John Harrison,
Yeah, he said John Harrison is Khan, and he knew a reason why. And, of course, I flunked him because that's what you do if you fail things in my classroom.
That's great.
Just kidding. I love that he was Khan. He was so powerful, so magnanimous. Just the scenes where he was inside that cell, it kind of reminded me of Silence of the Lambs a little bit. What did you think about
him? Well, I agree. Yeah, it reminded me also of Avengers. Obviously, Loki was captured in a very similar cell. And why do we put all the villains in these cells that are just, you know, glass houses for them to break out of? They always break out of them, too. I don't know. But go ahead.
But it's just cool.
It is. We like to see how they do it. And like you said, Benedict did a great job with the character. I've actually yet to see Wrath of Khan, the original. I know you kind of give me a hard time about that, and I'll have to check that out.
I chastised you.
You did chastise me a little bit. Yeah, you did. So I'll have to check that out and compare notes. So, but I'm eager to check out check that out. So,
yeah, and I guess it's relevant to say as far as our Star Trek fandom, we're not these people that hate Star Trek. I don't believe you can only like one or the other. Clearly, J.J. Abrams has come into the fold and sort of tried to make peace with everybody, the Capulets and the Montagues, you know, the Star Treks and the Star Wars fans. I've not seen all the episodes of any of the TV shows. I've not acknowledged anything besides After the Next Generation because it just wasn't something that interested me. That being said, I've enjoyed seeing the movies. I love Star Trek II. I didn't see that till later in my life either. But Star Trek II, I think diehard fans of Star Trek II, I'm really curious to see what they think of the end of this one. And maybe this is where we should talk about the end of Star Trek Into Darkness. And for me, of course, the big reveal in Star Trek The Wrath of Khan, of course, famously, Spock dies, he sacrifices himself, he opens up his humanity, he tells Kirk, I am and I will always be your friend, and then he dies. And that is the end of the movie. Now, in this one, of course, there's a big role reversal. And this is a lot of heat is coming down for this one, because instead of Spock dying, Kirk dies. And for me, I'm not sure what I think of this, and maybe our discussion will kind of bring it to fruition for me. But to me, the fact that he comes back at the end, I think they did a cop-out on that one.
Well, you know, again, I have not seen the original, and so it's hard for me to comment on it, but I know the basis of it. So my thoughts are that it was cool to see the role reversal, because to me it cemented their fact that their friendship was so much of a larger piece in this movie. And I think the role reversal was interesting, but you can't kill off a captain. You just can't. I mean, obviously this early in the series, if they plan to go forward with the third and fourth or however long the series goes, but they're not going to kill him off. I knew that even though as the scene was going on, I knew he was going to be killed off at the end. And it was kind of let down in the end. I mean, because you don't see a lot of main characters die off. I don't know. It just seems like they didn't kill. Well, he's not a spoiler. They didn't even kill Benedict. I mean, or Khan. So in the end, he's still out there. He's still a threat possible. I mean, they're just not going to do it. Obviously, he's got the star power to do it and the character power to just keep on rolling.
But that's the thing, you know, killing a character, and that's a higher level of concept that we could talk about. Do you have to kill someone to bring justice? They don't. They essentially freeze him, which is all of his people are. You mentioned something earlier about you can't kill the main character, but that's the thing. In Star Trek II, they did, and they led to a sequel, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. I don't know why they couldn't do Star Trek III, The Search for Kirk. You know, really look into that. And hello, we are stewards of our beloved franchise, Star Wars. What happens at the end of Episode 5, the most powerful, the darkest of all of them? Han Solo is frozen in carbonite, essentially dying. His spirit he's gone. He's gone for what? I forget how much time is between episodes 5 and 6. Like, I think it's 3.
It's 3 or 4 or something like that.
Yeah, and he's gone. They had a perfect opportunity to do that. And let we know, the second film in any trilogy now, everyone says, is this their Empire Strikes Back? Clearly, The Dark Knight was for the Christopher Nolan Batman trilogy.
I agree.
But how could you... I don't know. I had a hard time with him coming back. I'm glad that he did. I love that character of Kirk. Chris Pine is awesome. He's so charismatic. The ladies love him. The guys want to be him. You know, he's a great character. He'd be an awesome Han Solo. I don't think J.J. Abrams would do that. But I don't know. And then the whole scene at the end where he and Spock are fighting, that was very cool. Special effects heavy. Typically, in the end of these big blockbusters, I have a hard time with how they wrap up anyway, so I don't know.
Well, the thing is, like you said, it is a big blockbuster, and I don't know, they've done such a good job with it. I think everybody was so scared by the first movie about how they would be, it'd be done, and now even the second movie is even scarier because, you know, he does have Star Wars on his shoulders, which I don't think they knew that going into the production, but I mean, there is this twinge of fear. There's a fear out there that if, you know, you're going to screw this up, your career could be over. I mean, it could possibly be over. And obviously, J.J. Abrams has championed on, you know, obviously to do bigger and better things.
Right. And also, I guess it would be interesting to see what other people think about it. A lot of people I've talked to have said they don't like the role reversal. Again, that's the biggest source of contention. Not the fact that Khan is in it. He was beautifully played. I know Ricardo Montalban famously played him, did an exquisite job. It's hard to replace iconic actors in those roles. Whenever Indiana Jones is replaced, if that ever happens, not seeing Harrison Ford in that role, that's going to be difficult. You know, so they pulled off Khan. He was fantastic. Clearly, he steals the film. But the fact that they switch and have Kirk die, but then they don't go all the way. It's like they sell it, they cut it short. They go on this big risk, but then it's almost like they chicken out and they bring him back to life. So I had a huge problem with that.
Interesting.
You're going to have to see Khan and then you'll know.
I'll have to check out Khan and see your comparison. But, you know, some of the things that, like I said, I didn't like as far as the movie itself was the fact that it was a little cliche, a little bit. You kind of knew what was going to happen.
Exactly. And being that's a fan, why I didn't like the end. I agree. Yeah. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's the problem with the big switch. They turn it into a cliche. I mean, it was a cool, fun little twist, but then it was a cliche. Go ahead.
I think, no, I agree. I'm with you there, but I think, like you said, if they would have had Kirk die, I would have been blown away. I think as just an audience member, I just would have been like, whoa, I didn't expect that at all. And then it would have probably been a better movie for me. So, but I think, like you said, Benedict, who played Khan, just blew the character out of the water. He did a great job. I think that what made it a better film for me. I think if somebody else would have played that character and done, you know, a lesser job or not as well, I think the movie itself would have been not so great to me. I mean, all in all, I think it was a fun movie and film, but I think it was a little cliche here and there. So,
okay, so I guess if you had to give it, if there were 5 stars, 5 being the best, and obviously 1 or 0 being terrible, how many stars would you give it?
I would give it probably 3 stars. I agree, three stars.
Yeah, 3 stars for sure. You had mentioned earlier how this ties into Episode 7 and J.J. Abrams. I gotta drop some news for you. I saw on Twitter. It's just a rumor, and it just could be fans generalizing, and I'm sure that is. And I don't on a Coffee with Kenobi. I don't want to really address a lot of rumors because I'm not a rumor person. But I did see some fun speculation, and they talked about Benedict Cumberbatch, and they said, "Wouldn't it be cool if he played Grand Admiral Thrawn from the Zahn trilogy?"
You just blew my mind. That's, you know, I love the actor himself, and him to play that role would be probably icing on the cake. I wouldn't even care what else happened in Episode 7. I would just love to go see him act in that role. That'd be an excellent way to go. Will it happen? I don't know. And the other thing is, I thought too, a lot of people had said that Anton Yelchin, who plays Chekhov, would be a great, you know, young Skywalker, I guess, son, daughter, or I guess it'd be a Solo daughter. Well,
really? I'd never thought of that.
Well, I had read that early on. They said that he looks Skywalker-ish or Solo-ish. You know, has that bloodline. You know, just the character traits and his facial features and things like that. But to think that possible, anybody from the cast of this new Star Trek films could be cast in the new Star Wars Episode 7 films is always a possibility. So, like you said, if Cumberbatch decides to, you know, jump the river and, you know, go into Star Wars and you could play a character there, I would love it. I don't care who he plays, if he's an officer or something. I don't care. But
that's the thing. A lot of people there, and it's going to be mildly amusing and mildly annoying, to be honest. They're going to try to find every actor who's ever been in a J.J. Abrams TV show or movie and try to connect them to Episode 7. Personally, I don't really need that. I don't really care who's in Episode 7 as long as they're good, talented actors. And I think that this points to J.J. Abrams' strength as a filmmaker. He's only made a handful of films, but I can't think of a single film that he's made where you don't think the acting is great, the script is good, the chemistry on screen is good, and he uses a lot of green screens. I don't think we're going to see some of the foibles that are famously or perhaps infamously associated with the prequels, the stilted screenplay, the stilted acting, the wooden acting, whatever you want to say, whatever you want to call it. I don't think we're going to see that in Episode 7. This guy knows how to craft a story.
I agree. And I have confidence in J.J. Abrams a lot. I really do, from just the stuff that he's done. A lot of people, you know, downplay it and don't like it because, you know, his script writing's bad or, you know, things don't connect. Or there's no character connection, things like that. And that's to each their own, I guess. But as far as Episode 7 goes, yeah, the green screens and the special effects are obviously new and revolutionary and wonderful. And the other thing about J.J. Abrams is he loves to go this huge scale, this ultimate, like, what, you know, let's crash the Enterprise, let's destroy New York City, let's just do all these fantastical things. And I'm just excited to see what he's going to do with Star Wars. Will he do something, you know, extremely out of this world that's just incredibly just massive? you know, or really downplay it and just really connect with the characters and go from there. So
I agree. The sculpt, just that scene at the beginning where the Enterprise raises out of that body of water, that was beautiful. That was epic in scope. And he's got so many toys in the Star Wars sandbox to play with, the Falcon, the TIE Fighters. Maybe all these new things that are happening in the Star Wars universe. You know, they're going to want to sell Legos. They're going to sell video games and action figures and collectible sets. J.J. Abrams is going to make things so cool. And I think right now, let's talk about this whole lens flare thing. This is on Collider.com, and the whole lens flare thing came up, and it's been very trendy and chic to make fun of the lens flare. And I'm personally not crazy with it, and I think a lot of people who are making jokes that don't even understand what they're talking about. So I found this article, and Collider asked Simon Pegg about it. They say, who made the first joke about the lens flare? And I'm going to have to edit some of this because this is a family show, and Simon Pegg does not always think of that, but that's okay. He basically said, there's probably some film student who wanted to demonstrate his or her knowledge of film terminology, thus elevating themselves to an assumed level of critical superiority, which gives them this kind of smug, knowing smile that indicates a festering sour grape fizzling in the pit of their own ambition. It's become a sort of Camille stick to have a crack at JJ with, mostly by people who don't know what the beep a lens flare was, until someone started sneering this term all over their blog. It demonstrates JJ's supreme talent as a filmmaker, that the main means of knocking him is to magnify a throwaway artistic choice into some sort of hilarious failing. Lens flare is essentially an anomaly caused by light hitting the lens and creating refracted shapes. Because it draws attention to the fact that we are looking at a filmed event, it actually creates a subliminal sense of documentary realism and makes the moment more vital and immediate. In the same way Spielberg splattered his shots with bloody seawater in Saving Private Ryan, JJ suggests that the moment we are in it is so real and alive, there just isn't time to frame out all the light and activity. The irony is, by acknowledging the film's artifice, you're enhancing the reality of the moment. It's clever, and I love it. On set, we call it best in show, and our amazing director of photography, Dan Mindell, has a special technique to achieve it. To the detractors, I offer a polite beep you and suggest you find a new stick to beat us with, but being a huge, boring neggy balls is necessary for your personal happiness. And so that's what Simon Pegg, who reports... He's a big Star Wars fan. He's also a very famous prequel basher. But I love what he says about the lens flare.
Yeah, you know, actually, that's a great comment. I haven't heard that yet. And I agree with it. I really do. It is an artistical way to do the film. To me, it meant sleek to me. And it kind of has this new feel. It's like, this is the way we're going now. This is Star Trek is moving forward as far as the new films. And, you know, then maybe the next director won't keep with that. But yet... you get this feeling of like this is something we haven't seen in the way that he does that. Like, he does bring your attention to a scene when that comes on. I mean, you're kind of like your eyes are kind of like, oh, you know, offside a little bit. But I think it still is like this, almost like a flaw in the film. But yet these characters are so engrossed in what the actors are doing, they can't stop. So that's my take.
I agree. I mean, he knows his stuff. He knows from a lot of these guys who are lifelong film people. They understand the craft of filmmaking. And there's a literature term that I love to use, is verisimilitude. It's actually my very favorite word in the world, verisimilitude. And it means semblance of truth. It's when you take something that isn't quite truthful and make it appear to have some sort of semblance of truth or realism, right? And that's what he does. And I like how you described it. It's a beautiful way. It's a new artistic way of doing it. And it looks really, really cool. So for people who, lens flare, if that's your go-to joke for J.J. Abrams, you don't know what you're talking. All right, so how can we take this? How can we take Star Trek Into Darkness and sort of make predictions about Episode 7? We can't make legitimate predictions. I don't even want to make legitimate predictions. I do know that Michael Arndt is still working away at it. He's an Oscar winner for screenplays. J.J. Abrams is a master filmmaker. He's got people like Spielberg giving him suggestions. He's got George Lucas himself giving him creative tips and suggestions, and I'm sure he's going to be there all the time. What can we expect from Episode 7?
Like you said, we mentioned before, was great characters, great storytelling, great cinematography, just great connections with characters we know, characters we love, and would love to see again. I think that J.J. Abrams will bring a newness to the film. I think it's difficult to bring something so old and so beloved by fans into today's film market and be able to just cast it out there and let people see it and for what it is. And And it's such a beloved series that it's going to be so hated and so loved. It's going to be under a microscope so much, even through the production, through everything, the script writing, the characters, the casting, you know, down to the costuming, you know, every different weapon used, every different spaceship.
You mentioned the costumes. Michael Kaplan's already been slated as making the costuming for Episode 7. Did all the costume designing for the new Star Trek film. I thought the look of the officers' uniforms was really sleek and really, really cool. Something that fans would want to wear or look at. It's almost like Under Armour / Aquaman's costume meets Star Trek. And I think it's going to be awesome, whatever he does with Episode 7. And, you know, we already talked about on our first show, Michael Giacchino is not going to do the music, most likely. If he does, that'll be fine. He did the musical cues for the new Star Tours 2.0, The Adventure Continues. Whoever Abrams wants to take into the fold and make Episode 7 with, I'm okay with, as long as George Lucas thinks it's cool too.
Yeah, but you got to think, though, George Lucas is, you know, stepping back and playing a different role in this series. And I think it's going to really fall a lot on Kathleen Kennedy and the group there, and the Disney group, and J.J. Abrams. I think that he's going to have a lot of weight on his shoulders, even more so from, you know, doing Star Trek. The Star Wars film is going to be biggest than we've seen in years, I think, as far as filmmaking goes. And it's really going to really set a new trend as far as, you know, future films to come.
A new hope, is as it were. I think, I mean, you mentioned that Lucas was going to take a step back. I think we both know he's not taking a step back. I mean, he's not going to direct it, and he's not going to write it, and I'm actually okay with that. In fact, I'm happy with that, to be honest. As we've said many times, his genius lies in his creative mind and his passion and his vision, not in his ability to write, okay? So we don't have to deal with that. It really reminds me when Theo Epstein took over the Cubs, if we're going to use a baseball sports metaphor here. Before he took over the Cubs, he went to the Red Sox, who hadn't won a World Series for over 80-some years. Then he comes in, there's all this pressure, all this stuff going on, and then he takes him to win a couple of World Series. And then he goes to the Cubs. It's very similar to the Star Trek, Star Wars thing. He already had a lot of pressure on him when he took over the Star Trek franchise. I don't think that bothers him. I mean, I think initially he was reticent. He was clearly reluctant. He didn't want to do it. He was steeped in the Star Trek. He told Kathleen Kennedy no, and she wouldn't let it go. Thank goodness for that. And she pursued him, and then J.J. Abrams, his wife, helped him agree to do it. So he's almost like, I'm not going to say Star Trek was his warm-up, because he's a professional filmmaker. He doesn't need a warm-up. But it did prepare him for the pressure and the scrutiny that he's going to face. I don't think that's going to be a factor for him.
I agree. J.J. Abrams will do a great job. I think he's a good pick. But also, I think because he's a fan of the series. He loves Star Wars. So who better to get a fan themselves rather than, you know, some great filmmaker, which would probably do a fine job. But I mean, he's a fan, and he's said numerous times that he obviously studies, you know, George Lucas's stuff, Spielberg's stuff, and he loves all that, and he takes from them. So, and look back at Super 8, that was obviously a fan film from him, from his heart, you know, basically points back to the monster movies of Spielberg, you know, I'm trying to think of Goonies and all those characters, and almost kind of wraps it all in one little thing. It's kind of a love letter to Spielberg and those filmmakers that he loved.
That is exactly what I was going to say, that love letter thing. And we already know this whole idea of being a passionate fan, how that works in the Star Wars universe, because Dave Filoni is a lifelong Star Wars fan, and the Clone Wars turned out better than we could ever possibly imagine. Now we've got a filmmaker who's a passionate Star Wars fan, famously so, and he's going to make Episode 7. So I think if we can take anything from Star Trek Into Darkness, we can, at least to me, my final thoughts would be, he knows how to cast, he knows how to tell a story, he knows how to make special effects be a part of the story, but not be the focal point of the story. And I think a lot of people would say that some of the prequels kind of fell into that. I don't know if I always agree with that, but I think he's going to take special effects and use them as a tool, but not forget the characters and their chemistry. Personally, I can't wait to see what he does with Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, and Mark Hamill, assuming that they're going to be in Episode 7, and I certainly hope that they will be.
I agree. I think J.J. Abrams will do a great job. I am confident in what he'll do. I think even seeing what he's done with a sci-fi film and a franchise like Star Trek, it's really nice to be able to see that even before we see Star Wars, because I think that gives us an idea of what, okay, he's really handled this really well, he's handled the characters really well, he knows how to cast, like we've said. I really feel confident even having these two films under his belt that he'll do a great job.
Our topic for show number 3 involves attachments in the Jedi Order. What draws Vader to the dark side? Why can Jedi not have attachments? Is this the main flaw that leads to their downfall? This is something that's been bothering me for a long time. It was explored a lot in the films, explored quite a bit in the Clone Wars. It always comes up with Anakin, particularly when it comes to discipline for Anakin. It comes up famously at the end of Episode 2, Attack of the Clones, when Anakin has to decide, should he go and save Padme, or should he stay with Obi-Wan and try to stop Dooku? It comes up all the time in the Clone Wars. It comes up in Episode 3. It comes up in all the films, as we know. But the whole thing with attachments has always bothered me as a flaw. And why do the Jedi not see that? This is a topic rich for discussion, and we cannot wait to see what you have. Please email us with your comments or questions on attachments and how it involves the Jedi Order. And we will definitely discuss them on show number 3.
I like the sound of that.
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the comments section. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi, as well as keep up to date at our Twitter feed at twitter.com/coffeewithkenobi. If you enjoyed the jazz music, download the album Eye to Eye by Steve Torok on iTunes.
Give the evacuation code signal.
And that's going to do it for our Coffee with Kenobi special edition Star Trek Into Darkness J.J. Abrams and Episode 7 special. Thanks for listening, and we hope to see you soon on coffeewithkenobi.com. This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm Limited and is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names and sounds, and any other Star Wars-related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney or their respective trademarks and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi, unless otherwise indicated.
There's no one here. Move along.